Today's episode of Ariel Helwani's MMA show contains explicit language that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Back in your life on this Wednesday, November 20th, 2019. Hello again, everyone. I'm Ariel Helwani. Welcome back to the pod. Hope you're doing well. It's a relatively cold and gloomy day here in New York City, but I love doing this show each and every week. And we got a fun one planned for all of you. This week, we are going mano a mano with one of my favorite combat sports journalists of all time. He is the voice of British combat sports. He is omnipresent. He is prolific. He is inimitable. He is incomparable. He works for, now, bear with me here. It's a very long list. Telegraph Sport, Talk Sport Radio, Fighters Only, Ring Magazine, William Hill, Channel 5. The guy's all over the place, but he is kind enough to carve out an hour of his day to talk to us, and he's got a lot going on. And in fact, we're going to get a little personal here. I've been wanting to do this particular chat with this man for quite some time, and I'm very thankful that he has agreed to do it. So first things first, let's say hello to the great Gareth A. Davies, a.k.a. The Warlock, a.k.a. Kung Fu Panda himself. Gareth, how are you?
A very good evening to you from the United Kingdom, Ariel. What a lovely intro. You do know how to fillet your guests in the nicest and most poetic ways. It's lovely to be on with you. I think it's the third time
yes.
I've been on with you, and I'm actually, if I can say, really glad to be here. It's just a hint of maybe what we're going to talk about.
Absolutely, yes. For now, though, tell us where you are right now, because I understand that you are leaving from a pretty special shoot and you're en route back to London. Where exactly are you and what did you do today?
I set off early this morning from London, up to Sheffield to the English Institute of Sport, where twice a year we get to the media, get to spend the day with Anthony Joshua, the former WBA, IBF, and WBO heavyweight champion of the world, who fights Andy Ruiz for those three belts. His nemesis tries to get the belts back from his nemesis on December the 7th in Diriyah, Saudi Arabia, the dust up in the dunes, as they're calling it. And I had some very privileged time today, over an hour and a half, myself with Anthony Joshua, firstly with the cavalcade, the phalanx of British national newspaper media guys, then had Anthony Joshua on my Talk Sport radio show. And lastly, and hence leads me to, I'm in the car of a chap called Mr. Tony Kenny, who's the head of PR for William Hill. And we've just been filming for the last hour with Anthony Joshua. It's always his last gig of the day at his training camp when he has an open day. And we have a sit down with him. We go over a lot of things, and he gives us his final prediction as well on what's going to happen when the bell rings in his next fight. It's always, you know yourself, it's a great privilege to be around great stars of the fight sports, because I know everyone laughs when I always say this, you get up close and you get to smell and sniff and get a real sense of how they feel going into fight time. And you don't get it from an armchair. And you know yourself, you get very special senses on fighters when going into the very, very big and important historic making moments of their life. And Tony and I are just driving back down from Sheffield, which is in South Yorkshire, and it's about a 2.5 hour drive now back to London in the dark.
And you know, I'm actually a little bit envious of this particular experience that the boxing media gets before a big fight, because this isn't something, as you know, that we get to do in MMA media. Like, you get, usually when you're covering a big fight, like for example, UFC 245, Colby Covington, Kamaru Usman, we don't get a chance to sit with these guys at their training camp, at their gym, weeks before the fight. In boxing, this is something that's been done for years. You know, you see those photos of the journalists hanging out with Muhammad Ali and the Catskills. This, to me, is what makes covering boxing really fun. It's a lot different when you get a chance to sit with them weeks out in their element, as opposed to already at the venue fight week. It's a whole different ball game, right?
Yeah, I mean, don't you remember those old black and white photos of of some of the most famous American writers like Norman Mailer, sitting in Ali's hotel suite with him, regaling them with stories. And I think there's a different tradition. I mean, having said that, I did see you sitting with Tyson Fury and Triple H the other day, and I felt a pang of envy myself as two guys who I absolutely adore, and Tyson Fury is a good friend as well as a professional subject. I think the way that, you know as well, though, that if you've got a relationship with a mixed martial arts fighter, you can go to the gym and spend the day with them. There is, you and I particularly, we're afforded special privileges because people know how we'll treat them, and they know that we will go deep with them and go sound with them. Some of your walk and talks with some of the great MMA fighters away from Fight Week have been extraordinarily fascinating. But yeah, you're right. There is a different rhythm to the build up in boxing, and I think the time martial artists, particularly with the UFC, you can set times and scrums, and it's very hard to get exclusive, genuinely exclusive interviews and time with the biggest names. As you know yourself, Ariel, even though your Monday night show, the Ariel Helwani show, is a fulcrum for people breaking news. Look at Ben Askren this week, breaking on your show the very fact that he is retiring from the sport. You know, you get those privileges because you've earned them. People know the wideness, the breadth, the depth of your audience. But I think there's a different rhythm to MMA, and I do think it'll change as time goes on as well. I certainly hope it does.
Yeah, and of course, I'm comparing a sport that's been around for over 100 years to one that's been around for 26 years. So I agree with you. I do think it will change over time, and the media coverage will change as well. By the way, one last thing on this particular fight, which is coming up in just a few weeks. How big of a deal is it in the UK right now? This rematch, the shocking loss, the comeback of Anthony Joshua. Do you feel like this is a massive deal, bigger than any of Joshua's fights in the past, even though it's happening in Saudi Arabia, of all places?
It's huge. It's a high-risk, high-reward fight. Anthony Joshua is a massive media figure in the UK. His fight with Vladimir Klitschko in 2017 peculiarly didn't win him British Sportsman of the Year. It was one of the biggest events we've seen in a very long time. Remember, it filled out, and there were people still not able to get in the national soccer stadium, Wembley Stadium. I mean, I remember on the day, you can always... My meter register, if you like, I was on the equivalent of the Today program on the radio, you know, literally the adult political program early in the morning on the day of that Klitschko fight, talking about it. And the next morning on the BBC sofa, on the breakfast show in the morning, that's how big it was, certainly from my own experience. It was enormous. I think Anthony Joshua has been a big sleeping star for the last 5 months. I think all will be forgiven. The redemption story, and expect the redemption song to come kind of parading in with its lovely melody late on Saturday the 7th of December, early through the Sunday morning, December the 8th, if he gets that victory, if we all witness Andy Ruiz sleeping on the canvas as a result of the fistic prowess of Anthony Joshua. He needs this victory, Ariel. Otherwise, he will go down in history as the great young heavyweight who couldn't deal with the younger fighters with fast hands. I thought he was in great form today. Got a bit of an attitude about him, but he was very edgy, and it's great to see. And I think he was a bit too relaxed. It all came too easily for him, unifying three of the four world title belts within 22 fights. And it was a proper wake-up call for him, and he's back to a challenger's mentality. And he said to someone today, actually, I'm no pussy, was his words. I didn't need mental health channeling, or I didn't need mental health support after the loss. I'm no pussy. I'm made to be a champion. And you don't normally hear those kind of words from Anthony.
Okay, well, unsurprisingly, you have made me even more interested in that fight with your way of words that you have. By the way, are you going to Saudi Arabia for that?
Oh, God, I'm going to have to come clean here and reveal it all. I'm not allowed to do long-haul flights for about
another 2.5 weeks, actually, because I had a procedure about a week ago that has precluded me from flying.
What happened?
Well, you don't even know the full story here, actually. About 14 weeks ago, I had what I'm now calling a Randy Couture. Yeah? I had what our great friend Randy Couture had. I had a heart attack. I didn't know it was a heart attack at the time. I was in my bed at home. It was just, I just thought I was having a rough Friday night. I've had a lot of rough Friday nights in the past. I had a sore chest. It felt like I'd pulled a muscle in the left-hand side under my ribs. And I just took some painkillers and got through the night. And on the Monday following, I was due to go to Las Vegas to interview Tyson Fury and Bob Arum that I'd organized. And on the Monday morning, I just wasn't well enough. On the Saturday, I'd gone to do my radio show for Talk Sport. My arms felt so heavy. I'd never felt them as heavy before. And I just, for some reason, I had about 6 or 7 America, Dublin, LA, San Jose, Las Vegas, all coming up, Milan and Dublin, over the course of about 7 weeks. I just thought, I cannot travel feeling like this. I went to see my doctor. She took me straight into hospital, called an ambulance, and they took an ECG in my blood, and they said that I'd had a heart attack the previous Friday, 3 days earlier. They checked the enzymes in your blood. I was immediately admitted to a cardiothoracic hospital about 50 miles away in Essex. And I had an angiogram and an angioplasty. They found I had a blocked artery in the right-hand side of my heart and a narrowed artery in the middle. It didn't work, but my heart was still functioning fine for me to operate. I was told not to fly at the time and to take it easy. I was put on a ton of medicines, told never to smoke again, either what I was smoking or what Nate Diaz smokes. And so for the last 12 weeks, 13 weeks, I was on great medicine. I will never smoke a cigarette again. If I have a CBD or a THC, it'll be a gummy. I will not take painkillers again. I will take aspirin for the rest of my life. And I really have to look after my health. We're all going plant-based. So last Thursday, about a week ago, I went in for after an MRI scan, I went in for two long stents in that artery on the right-hand side. Thankfully, it was successful. Thank you, Dr. Paul Kelly, my surgeon, a consultant cardiac surgeon. It was a 90-minute procedure. I was awake during it. I was sedated, but awake. It was an extraordinary experience. And in 3 months' time, Ariel, he's going to pop another stent into my middle artery that's a little bit scarred. And I feel, you know, as happened to Randy, he walked into hospital, he was treated, he went out the next day. I had a similar thing, but I've had 100 days pretty much to change my lifestyle, and I'm really happy to be here. And it is the proverbial wake-up call. Just one of those things where you know me well enough. A lot of people who know me know what I'm like. I run around at 100 miles an hour. Got strong life force, and it was my body telling me after nearly 30 years of doing this that I really need to take notice, and it was time to change a few things in my life.
Wow. And this is the first time you speak about this publicly?
A few people, people I'm friends with, like I had told you on a text that, you know, it happened and you were really shocked, you know, friends of ours. Ant Evans, who's a really old friend, I told him about it. Obviously, my family knew. A few people at the places I work, I needed to tell them that I couldn't fly and so on. I missed a few big fights because I couldn't fly. But it's the first time I've spoken about it publicly. I kind of realized that, we've got public, if your children are ill, you probably wouldn't want to share it with all of the people who follow you because you know, it's something to do with the work sphere. And, you know, it felt very personal at the time. And, you know, I wanted to get well first. And, you know, I'm very happy to talk to you about it, as we're two pals and we have been for a long time. And it just, I feel comfortable talking about it now that my heart is working at 100% again and my legs aren't burning when I walk up a set of stairs, or, you know, I feel like I could defend myself physically again. I've got some massive bruising around the femoral artery in my groin where they went in to put one catheter and one on my wrist as well. They put two catheters in because the surgeon had to go from both ends of the blockage, which is an unusual procedure, and get the wire through in a balloon and then the stent, or the stent and then the balloons. I feel, you know, the one thing I would say, if I am talking about it publicly, is this. I had a stitch in my chest for about 7 or 8 weeks before I did something about this. And I think there's so many of us who just power on through in life. Like, oh, I'll be all right. I'll take some painkillers and I'll be absolutely fine. And the truth is, if I hadn't gone to the doctor and I'd carried on doing those trips, I love what I do, like you love what you do. And the second artery would have blocked. You know, I'd have kept smoking. I'd have been doing my tequila binges in the evening in fight week, eating crap food during fight week, you know, eating late at night, working all day, rushing around. And I probably would have ended up with a massive heart attack that would have killed me. And it's that same thing that people say about prostate cancer. Don't worry as a man about going and getting checked. If you've got a pain in your chest, you know, I didn't have massive pain. I thought I've had more pain playing rugby, doing a bit of sparring, being hit by a cricket ball. You know, listen to your body and just go and get checked out, because all it took me was 5 minutes with a blood test and echocardiogram for them to be able to tell that I'd had a heart attack. And that's really why I'd like to talk about it publicly, because I'm here because for some weird reason I decided to see my doctor. It's not normal behavior for me, but I would always do that again.
Well, first of all, I'm delighted that you are okay. I was very worried when I heard about this. You know, I admire you greatly. I love you dearly. And it's a very scary thing because I'd seen you not that long ago. And to hear that, you know, as you say, you like to go 100 miles an hour, but you strike me as a relatively healthy person. You're active, you're athletic. And so it was a shock to hear this. And so I'm just so happy. And I think I speak for everyone, especially your fans, very happy that you are okay. You come across as unflappable at times and you could withstand a lot. I'm wondering, initially when you found out what was going on, were you scared for your life? Were you worried?
I think in a very, not really, because I'm not really built that way. I think my family were more worried. You know, I've got two daughters who are in their late 20s and they were like, oh my God, why didn't you go and check this out? Because they had told me actually to go and get checked out before this. My parents, who live a long way away in the Middle East, were worried. They're not from the Middle East, but they live there. You know, one of my daughters has a son. I'm a grandfather already. You know, I became a grandfather this year, and she was really concerned about it. And, you know, that was really nice. It kind of, I think it brings you closer to the people you love. I mean, it's really nice of you to say, you know, the things you're saying. And but I think very often when you're going through something, it's the people around you that are more concerned than you are. I do think when you talk about a wake-up call, and I think it's a bit, if I bring it back to fighters, there's a moment where you actually have to face your own mortality, is that you're getting older, that you can't do what you used to be able to do, that your body's telling you that your speed is leaving you. You know, the power is the last thing to leave a fighter, isn't it? We see fighters slowed. We might not tell them to their face, but we discuss it. We say, oh God, that person's become gun shy. That person slowed up. And I think in that way, on a personal level, I've done a lot of things in my life that people don't know about, you know, in terms of, you know, the type of work I've done or things I've done. People just see what you do that's out there on social media these days. But, you know, I've done a lot of things. I've been, you know, in revolutions working in the past and, you know, in Tiananmen Square in China when, you know, when I was a very young reporter, done things that give you massive adrenaline. It feels like you're going into a fight and you're staying in the action and it's like really thrilling and frightening. But I think I just the wake-up call was facing that we're not invincible, that, you know, that there is such a thing as mortality. And I think I realised that, you know, I can do my 100 million miles an hour stuff, but I need to sleep. I need to try and eat well. I mean, God, I take you back to Nick Diaz a few years ago, poking me in the belly and said, oh, you should be gluten-free one day. And I thought, God, you know, these guys are right. And no, they're really kind words. I think we have to, I've tried to learn a lesson from this, and I don't think I've had any choice, Aaron. And that's how I would kind of present it, really, in that way.
I think there's a lesson for all of us here, because I think we all just sort of are so worried about our jobs and our work, and you don't stop sometimes and take care of yourself. You say, oh, I'll be okay and I'll work out tomorrow and things like that. At your worst, how bad were you treating your body?
Hey, let's not. Hey, is this an adult show?
Oh, no, I don't mean in that regard, but I mean, like, you're talking about eating, like these things add up, right?
No. I'm not joking. I didn't burn the candle at two ends at one time. You know, I'm in my early 50s now. I mean, when I was in my 20s and 30s, you know, I was burning the candle at four ends, you know. You know, I mean, I the thing is that a lot of things I say to you off air, I mean, I could describe it now, but I used to party all night, have an hour's sleep, and then go and work all day, you know, in the wrong time zone. And, you know, sometimes you can't control your life force. Your life force is what you're given. You are as you are, you know. I mean, I've been with you at home with your, well, before you had kids, really, before your wife, well, while your wife was pregnant. And, you know, you're still working at 10 o'clock at night, doing tweets. There's news stories coming in. You don't stop yourself. You know, like you say, I've got six outlets that I work for. And what I've actually learnt, I never used to say no. If there was something that needed to be done, radio at 1 a.m, or, you know, getting up at 4 a.m, and then you're heading to an airport and you're doing a radio show before you go, and, you know, you're only squeezing in 3 hours sleep. That's what I've changed. I make sure I get sleep now. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm sort of uncomfortable just talking about me and my life, but, you know, I think if anything, you know, we, in our industry, we get to where we are by working really hard. But, you know, I think it might be an Oscar Wilde that said, you know, the thing you love the most is the thing that kills you. And I think in many ways, in the very stressful world we work in, we say, oh, no, I can deal with the stress, it's fine. But it's how the stress plays out on you, not the stress of actually doing what we're doing, but the stress at the other end of what it's taking out of us, the lack of sleep, the collateral lack of sleep, the eating late at night, the waking up with a very stiff neck because you haven't slept enough and taking painkillers for it, or codeine, or whatever it be, and just knowing, no, I need to get there. I want to be doing that. We're driven to do it. You and I are very similar in that way. You know that, you know. You know, you drive yourself, don't you? And I'm sure you might have your wife saying to you sometimes, Ariel, slow down, have a day off, which you find hard to do.
Absolutely. Just this past Monday, I was very sick, and I still went to do the show because I didn't want to cancel. I'm pretty proud of the fact that I've never had to cancel a Monday show. Watch me have to cancel it next week. But yes, I sympathize with what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. And sometimes I do feel like I don't take care of myself. So that's why I'm actually not just interviewing you here. I'm genuinely curious about the things, because you've been around a little longer than I have. And now I'm also curious about, like, what you're doing to not go down that path again. You talked about plant-based and all that. Like, have you drastically changed your diet, your lifestyle since suffering this?
Well, as I said to you earlier, I'll never smoke again. I'm trying to go more plant-based, which, you know, seems to be the health theme of the moment. I'm making sure I'm getting sleep. I'm learning to say no to things. And, you know, I've done enough that I don't need to keep proving myself over and over again. But I think more than anything is realizing how I react after I've been under stress, how the stress of work actually affects me in terms of my habits afterwards, bad eating and all of those kind of things. I mean, and more than anything, just to really enjoy it all, because I could have been gone. And I really have felt, since I've come back, I'm really, really enjoying it. I mean, I love what I do anyway. And I'm like you, I love what I do. It doesn't feel like a job, but I'm just really trying to make the most of it all, you know.
Okay, so you mentioned that you have one more procedure left in a few weeks, and then hopefully you'll be in the clear.
Three months. One more. One, he wants to drop one more stent. He'll give me another MRI scan, and he'll drop another stent into my middle artery because it's a bit scarred and a bit narrowed. And hopefully, I won't see him for 25 years. Then, you know.
Yeah. And then when can you actually start traveling again?
Listen. 3 weeks' time, listen, we can still do that fight we've always wanted to do that would make us millions like KSI and Logan Paul, you know?
No, I mean, seriously.
Yeah, 2.5 weeks. I'll be traveling again. I'm going to do Bellator Hawaii. I'm going to go to Nashville for New Year. Anyone wants to join me in Nashville for New Year, and we'll do some cowboy kicking, dancing. And
take it easy. Don't go crazy.
Yeah, exactly. But listen, what's wrong with listening to a bit of country music in Nashville at New Year?
Sure.
After a few fights in Hawaii.
So you just missed the Joshua fight?
I just missed the Joshua fight. Instead, I'm going to be doing a show from London with a guy I present with for William Hill, David Alorca, and we're going to have 500 people in a very large public house in London, and we're going to have Shannon Briggs and a few others there. We're going to commentate on the fight while it's happening, and we'll have a royal time without being involved physically in the dust up in the dunes.
Well, I'm happy that you have this new lease on life. I'm happy that you're okay. I'm happy that the combat sports world gets to keep you for several more years, decades, if you want to stick around and keep doing what you're doing. It's a great story, and I really appreciate you talking about it on the show, in all honesty, because I know this is a very personal thing, and you have a multitude of platforms that you can talk about this on your own. So we appreciate it very much. And now you're back to work, right? You just interviewed, as you said, Anthony Joshua. You referenced Tyson Fury. So let's transition back to work, because I know you're uncomfortable. Contrary to popular belief, talking about yourself constantly. I know you want to talk about the fighters and the stories and whatnot. You know Tyson Fury better than most, if not all, media members. What do you make, by the way, of this flirtation with mixed martial arts after the WWE little thing that he did recently? What do you make of this stuff with Darren Till and Stipe Miocic?
Well, listen, there's two words I'll use, and they're not an American audience won't be that familiar with them, but a British audience will. I think they're poppycock and codswallop.
What? I have no idea what
poppycock.
That means.
They are poppycock and codswallop, Ariel. Utter nonsense, frankly. Though, if I rewind 4 years before Tyson Fury fought Vladimir Klitschko, I remember a conversation with Tyson and his uncle Peter Fury, who was training him at the time, that he was thinking about a kickboxing match with Rico Verhoeven, who you'll be aware of is the glory heavyweight kickboxing champion, a brilliant fighter, because they'd had Rico in a sparring session with them, and they got to know him very well when they were in Holland, where he used to train, where his uncle has a place in the woods. I visited them once there, I think near Eindhoven. I could see him doing kickboxing. He and Darren Till are both managed, of course, by MTK Global. So, that was something of a PR move, I think, to have them together. It looked like, imagine those big, I remember you tweeting on it, oh my God, oh my word, oh wow. I mean, I think those huge elbows are like swords, like sabers, his forearms, he's got huge arms, massive knees. But frankly, he'd only need to be taken to the ground and it'll be all over. I don't think he's really ever done any groundwork. Again, I think it's all great PR for him. But I think, it's possible he could have a boxing match with Stipe Miocic. But he's got much more important things to do at home, i.e. in his real calling of being a boxer, with a man by the name of Deontay Wilder, some point early next year. And that's where he's made his name. He had a slight flirtation in the WWE, which was a lot of fun. But let me throw it back to you. Do you really think he's got a chance of having a serious heavyweight fight in MMA?
Okay, well, here's the thing. The thing is, and you, of course, mentioned Deontay Wilder. He's fighting this weekend, and he has to get by Luis Ortiz in order for that fight to happen, which seems like, you know, every time we talk about, you know, the next fight after the one coming up, the boxing gods laugh at us and say, yeah. Oh, I'm going to screw this up for all of you. But let's say he does get by him again, that fight happens. The thing is, even forget about the WWE thing, because that was just during his time off. No one wants to see him in MMA. He is the lineal heavyweight champion of the world. No one is talking about him in his prime right now as he's made this great comeback. No one is clamoring to see him in mixed martial arts. And conversely, no one is clamoring to see him fight Stipe. There are enough big fights for him in the boxing world, especially in that heavyweight division right now that has enjoyed this renaissance, to where I would say MMA fans and boxing fans would rather see Tyson Fury fight A, Wilder, B, Joshua, C, Ruiz, and on goes. So yep. I get what you're saying about the PR thing, but this is like the wrong kind of PR. Yeah, people are talking about you, but there's no one who even wants this to happen from the MMA world or the boxing world. Like, I think all MMA fans want to see Stipe fight DC again. I put out a poll and this reflected it. And I think all boxing fans want to see Tyson. Like, I don't think anyone is even clamoring for the boxing MMA stuff anymore. I feel like we've done that. We've seen it, and there's no intrigue anymore.
I agree. I completely agree. And I think I spoke to Ben Davison when this all came out, Tyson Fury's trainer. I'm very close with all these guys, you know. Like you, I can speak to people off the record, behind the scenes, just to clarify things. And Ben said, as usual, Gareth, he's just making fun of everyone, having a bit of fun with everyone. I mean, I remember a couple of years back, Tyson Fury announced his retirement. And we all went scurrying to our editors and wrote stories. And an hour later, he came on Twitter or Instagram and said, there you go, I can control you all. Ha ha ha, I was only joking, I haven't really retired. And then it's like, it's Tyson, he's got an incredible sense of humour. Look, you've spent enough time around him to know that you've got to be very astute when you're listening to Tyson, because he loves sending people up. I don't know if you met his team as well. They're a real bunch of jokers. I have a giant spider's puts on my back by them, all sorts, when I visit them in camp and at his house in Hollywood before the Deontay Wilder fight. They are great fun. And Tyson, I think he's in the happiest period of his life. You know, I spent time with him when he was 28 stone, and he just didn't look well, feel well. And I didn't know at the time that he was, you know, suicidal and going through terrible mental anguish. But you've been around him enough to know now. You've had him two or three times in interview spaces, and you'll have talked to him both on air and off air. He's an amazing subject, isn't he? He's a copy machine. He's a words machine. He's a real star, isn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the guy has it, whatever it is, and especially for heavyweight boxing champions. I know he doesn't have a physical belt, lineal champion, but that's just as prestigious in my mind, in a weird way. The man has it, and that's why I want to see him at his best, right? Like, at this juncture, the reason I didn't mind the Mayweather thing was because, like, okay, he had seen and done it all. He was towards the end of his career. It was fine. He wasn't taking another opportunity away from someone else. Like, we had seen all the fights for Mayweather. Of course, there are others, but, you know, been there, done that. With Tyson, there are a lot of great fights that I still want to see him compete in, especially this new Tyson Fury. So I'm happy that we share the same opinion on this, and I hope it doesn't become a thing. And I'm wondering how you feel it reflects on Stipe, the fact that he's like, nah, I'm not interested in Daniel. He made me wait. He poked me in the eye. I want this instead. As a fighting champion, don't you feel like there is an obligation to, you know, keep that belt moving along and not just kind of use the belt as a token to go out and do bigger things? I know Conor did it, but I feel like over the last year or so, we moved away from the money fight era, and we're now starting to do things the right way again and the normal way. And this is sort of something that was in vogue 2-3 years ago, and I don't want to see it come back.
I completely agree with you. I think you're spot on. I mean, there shouldn't be another argument that holds tenure with anyone else. I mean, look, I think John Jones against Stipe Miocic is a fight, by the way, that also interests me, if that could be done as well.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I mean, I think there's five fights in the UFC for me at the moment that could make them $1 billion. And I think Jones against Stipe, Jones against Ngannou, Francis Ngannou, I think is another one that's fascinating.
Yes.
Conor McGregor back against
Khabib Nurmagomedov and the trilogy fight with Nate Diaz. And I think what's the fifth? Well, that's four. And I think and Jones and Cormier three as well.
No mention of Masvidal. No mention of the Diaz brothers.
Well, as I said, Nate Diaz against Conor. Yes, okay. Trilogy fight.
Yeah.
I think there's $1 billion there for the UFC in those fights. You know, there's $1 billion to be made. If those five were all pay-per-view, you build those fights and they are enormous. And, you know, those are the giant names. I mean, Masvidal is an incredible character. I mean, I was very privileged to have an interview with him after he beat Ben Askren and wrote a cover story for Fighters Only. And I really poured my heart into this story, and I'm very proud of the cover story. It's not online. It's only in the magazine. So it might actually be online now on my own website, GarethAdavis.com, where you can read it.
Oh.
But I really tried to capture him as close as possible. I mean, I really pissed him off because I spoke to his agent, you know, Ibrahim Kawa, who's very tenacious, isn't he, as an agent?
Yes.
Very involved in him. He's done a brilliant job with him, frankly. They did a brilliant job of presenting Masvidal in the Nate Diaz fight, the way they promoted him. He's a fantastic character. He's very similar. I mean, I love the authentic Tyson Fury, Nate Diaz, and Jorge Masvidal are all cut from the same cloth, by the way. Tyson Fury is from 10 generations of bare-knuckle fighters. Two of his uncles, Burton and Bartley Gorman, are the bare-knuckle gypsy champions of the world, revered. You know, he's from fighting families on both sides, Tyson Fury. Masvidal, Nate Diaz, Tyson Fury, when they are themselves, we cannot but love them because they are so authentic. They are just things of beauty. And I know you share that view as well, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have said it any better. Again, you have a way with words. I do want to ask you about Conor since you brought him up. It seems like here in America, everyone's waiting with bated breath to find out, is he in fact going to return January 18th? Is he going to fight Donald Cerrone? Is he going to fight anyone? Are we going to see him fight really three times next year? How big of a deal is Conor watch in the UK? Do you feel like the sport has passed him by? Do you feel like the fans are over him? Or are people similarly waiting with bated breath for this announcement that he is back?
Well, I'm very, very frustrated, frankly. I saw Conor, had a few words with him at the Bellator event in Dublin where Michael Venom Page beats, I can't even remember who it was now, beat Richard Kiley a few weeks back.
Yep.
Conor came in with a phalanx of security guys. I'm not sure whether they were protecting him or they were stopping him from going into the cage again from the incident a couple of years earlier, which I was at as well, which was extraordinary. Conor seemed in great form, physically looked great. I mean, I shook hands with him, I had a chat, very short chat. And I said to him, you know, we're desperate to have you back. You know that. He went, I know you are, Garrett. I'll be back when I'm ready. You know? You know what he's like. He did a fantastic interview with you. I thought a little PR'd a few months back I think you're probably in Bristol, Connecticut, or you would have been in New York interviewing him for ESPN. It was a fantastic, you know, we haven't seen him open up for 40 minutes like that ever since, you know, he lost to Khabib. I thought it was fascinating. Conor watch has become, it's a bit like waiting for that rare bird species to return or that rare, beautiful bird that you want to see. And, you know, as an ornithologist, for example, you're waiting to see that beautiful eagle in that rare kind of kingdom or domain where they dwell. And you're having to wait months and months. You're not sure whether you're ever going to see them. I think nothing's certain around Conor. I certainly don't think, was it January the 18th, Ariel?
Yes.
That's been mentioned. What are we now? 7.5 weeks away from that? Eight and a half weeks?
Yep. Less than 2 months.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't been announced, has it?
No.
For me, a Conor McGregor return needs a 3.5 to 4 month layout, you know? Because it's an extraordinary event, him coming back. I don't think we'll see that in January. I hope I'm wrong. But if they were to announce that, I think it would have to be almost immediate. We all want to see Connor back because editors will pay the fees for all the writers to go and the broadcasters to go, and there'll be a feeding frenzy. You know, the fans will travel. The fascination of him coming back. Who will it be? Will it be Donald Cowboy Cerrone? Will it be Frankie Edgar because he's being brought in, not against Khabib Nurmagomedov or Nate Diaz to begin with, who are fresher fighters who've, you know, who've looked good recently? You know, I think, I mean, what do you feel? Do you think he should come back in New York or Las Vegas? For me, Las Vegas is the destination for Conor McGregor. I think he's made for Las Vegas. And I think the way the fans were in Las Vegas stays with Las Vegas. And you, it's people, fans are more desperate when they're in New York. I'd love to know your take on when you think he's going to come back and what's the best venue as well.
So I can tell you that they are pushing for January 18th. I can also confirm that the clock is ticking as you brought up, and it does seem at this juncture a little rushed, but maybe that's best for Conor because it's not like he's waiting for the signed bout agreement to start training. By all accounts, he has already begun training, and so he is gunning for that date. But yes, for us, you know, look, Mayweather-McGregor was announced essentially 2 months before, and you know, it happened, and maybe it was good that it happened in such a short amount of time. So I don't think it's horrible now, but yes, the clock is ticking. We're approaching the end of the month, and it seems like this is the right time. I wonder if, you know, we just saw with Darren Till, he had visa issues coming to America. This has been hypothesized that it could be a hurdle. So I wonder how they're going to get over that because he has had his fair share of issues over the past year. So that's something that, from what I understand, they are actively working on. I like the idea of Las Vegas. I also love the idea of it not being at T-Mobile and it being at the MGM Grand, the site of some of his greatest triumphs, the win over Chad Mendes, the win over Jose Aldo. Something about, all right, we're taking this back to how it all began. To
Poirier
where it all
began. As well, Dustin Poirier,
yes,
the winner of the Poirier. I prefer the MGM to the T-Mobile.
Do.
I don't know why. I love Studio A and Studio B, those huge cavernous media rooms.
Love it.
Where I was there once when Joe Calzaghe and Bernard Hopkins was made. You know, I'm sorry to talk too much. I know it's an MMA reporter's podcast.
No, that's
but
fine.
We were in, that fight was made there that day when they had a row in the media room. Bernard Hopkins said to Calzaghe, I was a couple of feet away from them, I'll never lose to a white boy. Boom. The fight was made, you know. The promoters were there. Richard Schaefer was there. Frank Warren's guy was there. Boom, the fight got made, you know. 50-50, they said. Boom, it was all on record. Done. Fight was done. And there's something special. For me, there's a magic about the MGM. I did so many Mayweather fights there. So many UFC events. Silver and Belfort was there, wasn't it? It was an extraordinary event. 16,000 at the weigh-in, the mask. Do you remember all that,
yeah,
Ariel?
Yeah. There's no soul at the T-Mobile
no,
Arena.
There's no media room. There's
no media room. Yeah, you're in a tent outside. No, absolutely. I love those two studios. Fans won't know what we're talking about, but like the media will know. And the fact that you can go from the hotel and there's that sort of concourse outside, it just feels completely different. And it feels like if we're going to get nostalgic about the return of Conor, and by the way, MGM is a location that has been discussed. I'm not just pulling it, you know, out of my back pocket here. I just feel like it would be very symbolic to have him return at that venue and to see if he can actually get these three fights under his belt and to see if he can actually return to form. So it's obviously the biggest story of 2020 as far as the sport is concerned, mixed martial arts in particular and combat sports, to see if he A, will come back and B, come back like he once was. And so we'll keep our eye on that. I love picking your brain about this stuff, so I'll continue to do so. You mentioned Ben Askren briefly. What do you think is his legacy? He retired on Monday on my program. And his legacy, I think, is a bit of a complicated one, and it has evolved, especially over the past year. But when you think of Ben Askren now and the way he went out, what do you think will be his defining legacy?
Well, I've had time to think about this because, you know, obviously he broke, as you say, he broke the retirement from the sport on your show. Authentic, totally a realist in choosing this time to do it. I think he's always been his own man. He's a fantastic promoter. I think if in the ancient Olympics at Pancration, wrestling and boxing, he would have been a global champion, made a general of the legions. But I just think that the timing, what was off in his career was the timing of him coming to the UFC. I think had he come, had he come maybe 4 years earlier, I think he would have been a different force. He was great to be around, just absolutely fantastic. And I always admire a guy who goes out on his own terms. And I think that's what he's done, you know, and he accepted losses so brilliantly. I loved the way he trash talked. Very, very bright. One of the brightest fighters you could ever really interview. But he just knew how to do it all. And I think some of those, I can't remember the name, there were some brilliant little documentary shorts made about him that I watched only last week that came out that just highlight how brilliant he was, even when he was a youngster, growing his hair big so he could be recognized above other young wrestlers. He was a tall poppy who had no fear, Ariel. And I think it's just unlucky that, you know, Robbie Lawler, Jorge Masvidal and Demian Maia were just too much for him in their own stylistic ways in his run in the UFC. I mean, I think it's very cruel of the schadenfreude that we've seen, you know, on some of the internet forums, some of the social media forums where people say, yeah, but trouble is UFC's 0-3. I think that's very
unkind. He did beat Robbie Lawler. Remember, it looked like he was going to lose, but he ended up beating him. Remember the controversial submission? But your point is, stands. It's well taken. Can I tell you what I think his legacy will be? This guy who was a perpetual winner in the collegiate ranks, made the Olympic team in 2008, then had that long run as an undefeated fighter, 19-0 before with one no contest before entering the UFC. I actually feel like his defining legacy will be the way he handled defeat. In the end, this guy who was so accustomed to winning actually showed us all what it means to be a loser. And I don't say that begrudgingly. I don't say that to insult him or to be critical of him. And he probably wouldn't like this to be his legacy. But the way he handled that loss to Jorge Masvidal, showing up on the Monday after, self-deprecating, humble, you know, able to analyze the performance and not hold a grudge, that to me was a thing of beauty. You don't often see that from fighters, right? I mean, Conor to me did it best because the spotlight was the brightest on him after the loss to Nate Diaz. Everyone was laughing at him, pointing at him, thinking that he was done. He showed up to the press conference, chest out, head held high, was able to take the criticism, face the music, and then got the rematch and won. But this guy, similarly, was very, you know, was very boisterous, talked a lot of trash going into the Masvidal fight, and got smoked in 5 seconds, the fastest knockout ever, and showed up on the Monday, didn't have to do that, and faced all the music. To me, that said all that I needed to know about Ben Askren. He did the same thing after the Maia fight as well. And so that's how, I know it's kind of funny for a guy who wants so much, that's how I will remember Ben Askren.
Yeah, but the great thing about this, and you said it there without saying it in a way, is that the great thing about Ben Askren is that he truly believes in who Ben Askren is. He didn't let the results of his fighting career define him as a person. So he walks away. He knows what he is. And it shows how much self-belief he has in who he really is. But also he knows that's why life after fighting will always be great for Ben Askren, because you can see that it was never the be-all and the end-all. You know,
and
I love that about some fighters, that they will not allow their persona as a fighter to be the ultimate thing that defines them. You know,
now UFC is off this weekend, but there's a really interesting Bellator card happening in London. You'll be a part of the broadcast, and you've done a lot of great work leading up to this card, and it's not getting a lot of attention here, but I like these European cards. I'm a big fan of Cage Wars. I'm a big fan of the European series. And there's a couple of names, actually more than a couple of names, on this card in particular that I want to ask you about. First off, the Fabian Edwards-Mike Shipman fight is a true grudge match that I think the European fans are a lot more in tune with than the American fans. And you had the opportunity yesterday, Tuesday, to actually sit down with both of them and kind of preview the fight. What was the tension like? What was the scene like? What was the mood like when you got to do that? And if you can explain for the non-European fans why these two don't get along, don't see eye to eye the way they do.
Well, Fabian Edwards, of course, is the brother of Leon Edwards, who's a big thing in the welterweight division in the UFC. They both grew up in Jamaica and moved to Birmingham. And Fabian's been to prison before. They were involved in gangs in Birmingham. They're properly from very, very rough neighborhoods. But you know, their lives have been transformed by going into the mixed martial arts gym, and they're brilliant young men. Fabian is a very dangerous fighter, kind of a kung fu style fighter with massive leg kicks. He's a very powerful athlete. I think he could have chosen to be a decathlete in track and field. He could have been a rugby player. He's got so many skills. He's a nasty, mean fucker as well, you know. I don't know if I can swear on this, can I?
No, it's okay. Not. No, we have a disclaimer at the top.
Yeah, he does. He's got a real mean streak about him. He's only, you know, he's a novice in many ways. So he's a very exciting prospect. And you know he's from the same DNA as Leon Edwards, who for me really probably is the best pound-for-pound fighter in the UK right now. You know, it's a close-run thing between him and Darren Till. You can throw a Paul Daly, a Michael Venom Page in the mix. But, you know, there are other guys knocking about. There are a few other guys. But with Mike Shipman, who's a former rugby player who trains out of London Shoot Fighters, where Michael Venom Page trains as well, they have had such a beef, both in public and in private, where a couple of years ago, Shipman, who's the much more experienced fighter, even sent a private message to Edwards and said, look, if you really want to fight me that much, come down to my gym or I'll come to your gym and we'll settle it in the gym. Let's just have a fight in the gym. And you don't often hear that from fighters. And he was totally serious about that. And yesterday, outside Wembley Stadium, one of the most iconic settings in UK sports, the home of the England soccer team where they won the World Cup in 1966. It's a really iconic venue, Ariel. I got to have both guys together, and they absolutely fucking hate each other. And they really do. And I was between them both. The disclaimer that I had to give them both yesterday on camera was, I've got strict instructions for both of you. And they had none of their teams with them, but they had some of the Bellator logistics crew and senior figures there. I had to say to them both, it's a message from Scott Coker, who's the president of the US of Bellator, and David Green, who's the head of Bellator Europe. So the two heads of Bellator in America, the head of the company, and David Green, who's the kind of head of European affairs, have given me strict instructions. If you guys lay hands on each other in the next hour that we're together, as we walk around Wembley and then go in the arena, the fight is off on Saturday night. And they both started chopsing at each other straight away. Look in your eyes. Your eyes are watering. I think you've done this before, but immediately I could feel adrenaline in me, because when two people either side of you could kick off at any moment, you're actually on tenterhooks, because you're thinking, I'm actually going to have to stop one of them or get in the way in some way, because I can't have, with five cameras on us the whole time, because you do not want a huge Fabian leg kick to come across you and smack into Shipman's face. But anyway, we sat down, we did a walk around Wembley. The interview is coming out, I think, Thursday or Friday. They sat down on the chairs. I had a chair between them. We sat in the bleachers, if you like, in the SSE arena. You know, we got the atmosphere of the place. And it was extraordinary. It was such a privilege to be between these two guys. We're expecting war. It's bragging rights in the middleweight division in Britain. I think it's going to be a very tough fight for both men, because it's the hardest fight either man will ever have had, in my view. And I just think it may well define the beginning of the rise of Fabian Edwards, because I think Fabian Edwards versus Darren Till at middleweight, even though they're in the UFC and they're in Bellator, would be it could fill out a really big arena when the fight's made at the right time, if both are in the UFC or if both of them are in Bellator. So it's a terrific secondary fight on the main card on Saturday night.
By the way, why do they hate each other though?
Well, they basically, yes, I didn't get there, did
yes.
I? And I was asking about that. I got to this in the interview. And the grudge has come about because Edwards is convinced that Shipman has been avoiding him for 2 or 3 years. Ah. And only when they were in Bama And Chipman was saying, no, I've been avoiding you. I'm going to fight you in your 3-0 or 2-0. I'm avoiding you. It just wasn't the right time. But Edwards is convinced that now that they're both in Bellator, Bellator are forcing Chipman to face Edwards. I think it's a really tough fight for Chipman, who's a real grinder, who will want to close the range, dirty box, grapple with Edwards, and Edwards will want to have space to let his hands and his feet go. I mean, he's knocked people out with up kicks. He's a very aggressive, very, very aggressive fighter who we've only seen at one pace so far, but I think there's a lot in this guy. And given he's the same kind of family, the same DNA as Leon Edwards, who I'm sure you rate, I think there's so much to come from this guy.
How big of a deal is MVP these days over there? I mean, he had the nice bounce back win, but again, it always seems like he's fighting, with all due respect, no-name fighters. He gets the one big fight against Douglas Lima and he loses, looked good in the return, but it was against another guy. Like, you almost forgot his name, Richard Keeley. Now he's fighting a late replacement opponent once again. How big of a deal is it when he's headlining a card like this?
Well, I think it would have been a bigger deal if it wasn't kind of an unknown Italian who was a late notice replacement rather than, was it Derek Anderson, wasn't it? Who I think would have been something of a challenge, who's a very experienced fighter, very tough, and would have had Page on, would have had Michael Venom Page on tenterhooks. I think with this guy, I see him, you know, with the likes of David Rickles and Richard Kiley and these kind of guys, he can just toy with them and look spectacular, which is great. But we look what happened when he fought Paul Daly. It was a kind of I was so excited about that fight, and I'm sure you're the same. I was so disappointed with the fight in the end, because you wanted to see these guys go to war and trade, but so often in these cases guys equal each other out and you don't get the outcome you want. The answer to your question is, again, I had an amazing interview with Michael Venom Page the other day, and we walked and talked. You know, you've done those interviews. You get extraordinarily different things out of people when you walk through a park with them, or through a market, or go to the graveside of someone they loved, or do take them out of that environment that they train in or they fight in, and away from the eyes of other teammates. I think he's still waiting for that explosion moment. People know that, you know, he's super talented when it comes to being a knockout artist, that he has a very different style, you know, but he's staying patiently with Bellator. I'd like to have seen him in this fight against Lorenz Larkin, believe it or not, but obviously he's fighting in Japan at the end of the year. I want to see him fight those level fighters only, because I think that's the only way that we find out that how good he really is. And I spoke to Douglas Lima about him. I've done the big interview recently with Douglas Lima, and Douglas said he'd never faced anything as fast in front of him. But I thought Lima was brilliant that night, and took it. He only needed an opportunity, and he took it. But is Venom Page a big deal? Yeah, he is. He's something of a big deal because of his personality and his style and all those things. But he really still needs that breakthrough moment. But I tell you, Ariel, there's 500,000, 600,000, 700,000 plus people watching these guys live on Channel 5, which is a big terrestrial network here, whenever they fight live on a Saturday night. It's Saturday night prime time. So, you know, he's got the opportunity for people to know who he is. But like you say, until someone's been in a real defining fight in a war, they tend not to cross over, if you know what I mean.
Final thing, you have the pulse of the Bellator execs, especially from the European perspective, and they're trying to really make a lot of headway, thanks in large part to this TV deal, but this European series as well. There seems to be a bit of a rivalry between the European division and Cage Warriors. And, you know, I listen to our friend P.T. Carroll on his podcast every week called Eurobash, and they've talked about how, you know, Cage Warriors, it seems like there's continuity between the events, and sometimes these European events feel like one-offs in Bellator. Do you sense that Bellator is concerned? Like, with it's essentially just two of them left, right? There's no Bama anymore. And Cage Warriors has reemerged as a player over the last couple of years. Do you sense that Bellator is worried about Cage Warriors? Do you feel like Cage Warriors is doing a better job of, as PT said last week on his podcast, having a thread between the events as opposed to these one-offs, multiple months between events?
Well, I have to jump to the defense, first of all, Mr. Niall McGrath, because it wasn't Eurobash last week. It was Niall McGrath Bash, if you remember.
Wow.
I mean that in a nice way. I mean, both of them are great friends. No, I think Pete was teasing Niall. Those kind of an in-joke there, really, and I think everyone in the know kind of will get that. It's people that follow Pete and Niall, who are two of the brilliant Irish journalists covering MMA. Both brilliant young people. I don't think Bellator are buying up the contracts with bigger names that are leaving the UFC. I mean, look at in recent times, just to digress slightly, buying up bigger names like Kat Zingano, Cyborg Santos, enormous. Christian Cyborg. Huge names for a featherweight division, frankly. So I think they're building from the top down, but they've also got a lot of young stars coming through. I think AJ McKee could go on to be one of the real pound-for-pound stars in the sport. I think their featherweight tournament is brilliant. Pedro Carvalho is a great guy to look out for. So he's fighting Pitbull soon into the new year. There's some real young stars emerging. Over in Europe, I think, given that they're owned by Viacom, that they've got a TV deal with Channel 5 and Sky Sports, which is, you know, the equivalent of ESPN, who you work for over there. You know how big ESPN is. The resonance that they've got with those two broadcasters is enormous here. So they just need time to keep doing what they're doing. I think the war chest is replete with greenback money from their deals with DAZN and what they get from Viacom, Paramount, CBS, all those places. So that next year we're looking at around 10 events from Bellator in Europe. I don't think they see Cage Warriors as a threat. They might want some of their players, some of their fighters. But everyone I speak to is very happy with, who's been signed by Bellator, is very happy with the deals they're getting and the opportunities they're getting. A lot of the very good British fighters want to go and fight in America. It's still seen as the holy grail by many of them. But they just need those breakout moments. I think MMA is healthy. It's rich here. The UFC has a big star in Darren Till, and if they get the right fights, they'll be able to sell out here and build around him and Leon Edwards. Love to see those two fight. But I think, the sports, we're five, six, seven years behind you always, and I think that's what's fascinating. And it's really great to have the opportunity to come both sides of the pond to do it, Ariel.
Gareth, I love you. I've kept you in your car for the last hour, and we could have talked a lot more about KSI Logan Paul and Nick Diaz and all this stuff, but we're out of time. Most importantly, I'm so happy to hear that you're doing well. I'm happy to hear that you caught the heart attack relatively early and that it was not worse and that you are on the mend, that you will be able to travel again. I appreciate you talking about it on the show. And I want you to take care of yourself, all right? Now you have grandchildren. You got a lot of people who love you. You got the UK fans who need your reporting and your great storytelling. So please take care of yourself, and I hope to see you soon once again face-to-face in this little closet that they have me doing the podcast, all right?
I cannot wait to be there with you again, mate. Next time I'm in New York, I would love to do it. And listen, thanks so much for your kind words today. And I'm almost a bit embarrassed about how much we talked about my health condition on the show this week. But it's lovely of you. And I wouldn't have wanted to talk publicly on any other show with anyone else but you, frankly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. Well, enjoy the fights this weekend. Keep up the great work, and we'll talk to you soon. And again, take care of yourself.
Always a pleasure. Thank you very much, Ariel.
All right. There he is, the man, the warlock, Kung Fu Panda. Like I said, William Hill, Channel 5, Telegraph, Talk Sport, Fighters Only, Ring Magazine. The guy's got a million jobs. It's unbelievable. But still ticking, still going, and we're glad to hear that he's doing okay. Now, before we go, let's check in with TST. TST, are you there?
Yes, Errol, I'm here.
Good to hear from you, TST. How about that, Gareth?
He's quite the character. I loved having him on.
By the way, can you mute your computer when you come
on
the show?
I'm sorry, people want me. I can't. Plus, I don't even know how to do it. There's techie things that you don't know how to do. There's techie things I don't know how to do. I'm not very well versed in this technology. Actually, I'm quite averse to it, as you know.
Which is weird, considering your job. By the way, how do you know that there are techie things that I don't know how to do?
I hear conversations that you have. That's the pleasure of having the job that I do, Ariel. I get to hear your back channel conversations.
Now, what was the feedback to the first installment of TST's Minimalist Tip of the Day?
Hold on. It's a tip of the week.
Yes, I wanted to see if you were paying attention.
Tip of the week.
Yes, yes.
As you were sure to point that out to me. I got great feedback from people who are trying to adopt minimalism, and I hope that you adopted some tips yourself. You said last week they were reevaluating your life.
I don't know if I actually said that.
You did say it.
Verbatim?
Yeah. You said I'm reevaluating right now.
Well, that's not accurate. Anyway, without further ado, do you have a second installment of the tip of the week?
TST's Minimalist Tip of the Week.
Yes.
You're darn right we do. Okay, so my tip this week, it relates to what we just talked about, actually, is to eliminate distractions from your life. And the distractions that I'm referring to here are like your computer, like mine that you can hear in the background, cell phones. This is why I do Screenless Saturday, because once you remove those distractions from your life, it is so easy for us all the time to... We call them these pacifiers. If you don't want to think, you can just scroll on Twitter, scroll Instagram, turn on the TV, turn on Netflix, whatever it is to turn off your mind. And you don't actually have to think. We don't spend much time with our thoughts anymore, Ariel. And I spend a lot of time with my thoughts on Screenless Saturday and on other days throughout the week. I'm very deliberate. There are times where I should not be working, because you can always drown yourselves in work or in online communication. So it's very important to eliminate those distractions, because once you do that, you get more comfortable with being around yourself, more comfortable with connecting with the people around you, and then you really learn how to fill your time. I once did this thing where I deleted all the apps on my phone, and then I would go on my phone to, you know, distract myself, and then I'd be like, all right, wait, there's absolutely nothing on here that I can look at right now. What do I do? And so then it was at that point that I learned, you know, what do I like to do? You know, I like to write. I like to walk. I like to exercise. I like to go to little fancy coffee shops and just hang out for a while. Those are the things I love to do. And I learned that by eliminating some distractions from my life.
Can I tell you one thing that I'm trying to do, but I'm very unsuccessful in doing, is not looking at my phone right before going to bed. Like, you know, as you just mentioned, scrolling through. Just sort of mindless wasting time.
Yeah, you shouldn't look at it before bed. It's bad for your eyes. And it's bad for your health and it interrupts your sleep. And you shouldn't look at it first thing in the morning.
That's the other thing.
So many people do that. They just roll out of bed, Twitter, Instagram feed, and they stay in there for like 30 minutes. I was thinking about this earlier today. Like, I wake up excited to attack the day. I don't even look at my phone because I just can't wait to get to the day. I feel like if you roll out of bed and you're already just deflecting to turning off your brain, like you're setting a bad course for your day. You know what I'm saying?
I appreciate this. I'm going to try. I'm not saying I'm going to be successful in actually implementing these tips to my life, but I do think there are great values. I think we've taught people some great life lessons today with Gareth and yourself. I feel good about what we accomplished.
I think we have. And I think you need to heed some of his advice, Ariel. I'm concerned about you. You work too much.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't know if the people who employ me agree with that, but I do appreciate your concern. I was very sick on Monday, truth be told. I didn't say it on the show itself. You couldn't tell, right?
No, I couldn't tell whatsoever. Before, you looked sick as a dog, but on the show, you acted very well.
I turned it on. I couldn't let Ben Askren not make his announcement. I had to be there. It was a big deal. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what I mean. Do we want to do this review here?
Yes, review of the week. Here we go.
Okay, so
we don't have a fancy jingle for that. Oh. We got music.
Yeah, this is music.
Now, what is this music?
This is unrelated to a country, so I just, you know, found some generic fighting music.
Interesting. Okay. It seems a little derivative, but fine.
All right. So here's D Gold, who gives us a 5-star review with the title, Ariel is the best. In his review, no one does it quite like Ariel. His passion and authenticity is genuine and evident every time.
Wow. It's very nice. Thank you. I appreciate that. That warms my heart. Keep reviewing, by the way. Keep commenting. Keep leaving You know, your little comments, we'll read them each and every week on the program. The best one and the 5 stars is much appreciated as well. And again, December 13th, I can't quite say what's going on, but I feel like if you're smart enough, you understand what's going on. December 13th, Las Vegas. I actually heard through the grapevine that TST will be there as well.
I'll be there, baby, in Vegas. My first time.
First time ever?
First time ever in Vegas. Yeah, let's party.
I feel like this needs to be a documentary. The Minimalist comes to Las Vegas for the first time.
Oh, wow. We could put it on ESPN Plus.
Yeah, that would do big numbers. Huge subscriptions coming as a result of that. All right, we're out of time. There's the music. It's been a fun day. I mean, honestly, and allow me to just sort of self-indulge you here. To have Ben Askren on Monday come on the show and want to come on the show and announce his retirement in this day and age, as I've written a couple times this week, athletes can announce these things wherever they want these days. Social media, it's almost easier for them to do it that way. They can control the narrative. They can control the story. The fact that he called me last Monday and said, I want to come on the following Monday, I'm going to sit on this news, it's a huge honor. I'm very touched by it. And again, the fact that Gareth just said multiple times that, you know, he wanted to talk about this with me and didn't feel comfortable talking about it with anyone else. He hosts his own shows. He could have just done this on his own. Again, it's a huge compliment and it means the world to me. And so I'm very thankful as we approach the holiday season, Thanksgiving here in America. I'm thankful. I'm grateful for people like Ben Askren, for people like Gareth A. Davies in our lives. This is what makes covering combat sports and MMA in particular so great. These characters, these people at this point in my life, the fights, they can come and go, but it's these personalities, these characters that I've come to establish relationships with over time that really makes this all special. So thank you very much to them. Thank you very much to all of you, as always, for listening. Thank you very much to TST for his great work behind the scenes. Continue to subscribe, rate, review, all those things and more. Enjoy the fights this weekend. I'll talk to you next week.